Welcome to the Public Morality. Last week will forever be remembered in the annals of American history. Within 48 hours, Georgia, who had been traditionally a red state, followed up on the heels of the election victory for President-elect Joe Biden by sending Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff to the United States Senate, thereby giving Democrats a majority. The next day, what has traditionally been a ceremonial exercise, 12 Senate Republicans vowed to oppose the certification of Biden's Electoral College win. Then, the unthinkable occurred, with a cabal of Republican senators prepared to challenge the certification of Biden, America's 227-year tradition of a peaceful transfer of power abruptly came to an end. With the final push from the President of the United States, rioters stormed the Capitol, planted a noose outside, some brandishing the flag of the Confederacy. Members of Congress were ushered to safe locations, and Capitol Police could be seen with their guns drawn, barricaded inside congressional chambers. A morbid response to derail a free and fair election. And then the following day, President Trump, in a two-minute speech, appeared to finally concede the election to Joe Biden. To discuss an incredible 48 hours in American political history, I'm joined once again by political commentator and professor Joe Tooman. Joe Tooman, welcome back to the Public Morality.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Good to talk to you again.
Has our democracy ever experienced a 48 hours similar to the past week?
Man, outside of the era of the Civil War, I can't think of anything that rivals what happened this week. I think this is unique, and we've certainly had threats for our country that we could compare this to, I suppose, but we have never had, in to my knowledge and memory, an active insurrection that was incited by a sitting president, based upon that president's unwillingness to accept an election result and perpetuation of what everyone around him knew was a lie. I mean, this has just been pathological and bizarre. And certainly, to answer your question, therefore, completely unique. I can't remember any time in history like this. It's awful.
Let's just start with how the week began. When we first contacted you, what I thought we would be spending most of our time discussing. But I remember in September, October, political pundits were suggesting that the pathway to the Democrats getting a majority in the Senate ran through Maine, ran through North Carolina. I don't know of anyone that said that it depended on Georgia flipping both seats. Talk about the importance, if you will, of that election.
Well, we'll start with the November election, obviously, which is the one in question as far as the president was concerned. Georgia has been historically a red state, a conservative Republican vanguard. But, you know, states go through periods of transition politically. It's not uncommon at all because you have different migrations of new populations that show up in those states when the states engage in invest in development, to bring in new colleges or universities. You attract new populations of people when there are job opportunities there or cost of living or housing is better, people move. And so over time, I think in ways that were perhaps more subtle unless you live there, Georgia went from being a red state to potentially being what we would call sort of a purple state, meaning something in between conservative and or liberal. And it was, I think, a place in that sense that was not only ripe for new Democrats and registered Democrats and formerly non-participating black voters, you know, who had not been solicited, who had not been encouraged to register before, who also had to face, let's be honest, massive voter suppression efforts, not just in the state of Georgia, but in other parts of the South. Things changed. And I think that Stacey Abrams had a lot to do with making sure that those people were registered to vote. The other inclination I have about this is, besides the emergence of a very strong black vote, which I think was responsible for giving Mr. Biden the win in the end, you also have to factor in independent voters who are sick of both parties, Republican and Democrat. I haven't seen the final numbers for both Senate seats, but I can tell you I did see them on independents for one of the two Senate seats, which is Mr. Warnocke's seat, that he got more than 50% of independent votes in this last election, which is part of the reason he was able to beat the other candidate in this race. I suspect the same was true for Joe Biden in November, that independent voters also played a role in this. And what that teaches us, I think, in the end, is that both of these parties, Democrat and Republican, are aging. They're going to have to reconsider what their identity is and what they're about. Usually political parties reflect the breadth and the diversity of their members. And I think both parties in the state of Georgia are going to go through a transition. And I actually think that's something we're going to see nationally as we go forward.
And as a result of, especially on the independent piece, what I'm hearing you say, in many ways, just sort of given the bifurcation of the two parties, it really makes independent voters the de facto kingmaker in a lot of statewide races across the country, is what I'm hearing you say.
Absolutely. And let me also say, on the Democratic side, you know, there is a strong progressive group within, and there are also African-American voters, black voters, who, you know, have been solicited by the Democratic Party in the past, but who's all, you know, sometimes feel as if, you know, the party wants them when it's time to vote, and otherwise the party's not always putting their issues at the top of the agenda. Where's the follow-through? When you have so many young black males being killed, murdered, let's just call it what it is, by police officers using excessive force or inappropriate force in these situations, where is the legislation that changes that? Where are the political Democratic leaders elected who are going to challenge very strong police officers' unions or sheriff's unions in this country and demand a transition? Lots of states, for example, have gone to encouraging the use of those on-person cameras that the police officers are supposed to wear, and they do. And what a coincidence, those cameras seem to have been turned off just at the moment a young black male is being shot, consistently, so that evidence doesn't exist. I mean, well, black people aren't stupid. They understand what's going on. And so back to this point about for the Democratic Party, I mean, they should be as concerned about the changing of the times and the emergence of a very strong, particularly in the South, black voting pool, African-American voting pool, that these people aren't just going to give their votes away. They're going to demand changes as well. And those changes will force changes in the Democratic Party in the same way that the Republican Party is going to have to do a major overhaul as well. I mean, the Republican Party is more screwed up than the Democratic Party, and that's saying something. Majorly screwed up.
So we're still staying with the Georgia Senate race, what impact did the president have on that race, in your view?
A huge impact, I think. First, remember that there was the residue of the November election. In a state that people thought would stay red, it went blue. It went to the Democrats. And, I think in the state of Georgia, a lot of people weren't just voting for Joe Biden. They were voting against Donald Trump in that sense as well. And so that was the first impact. But if we're talking about, like, in the last weeks of the Senate race, the runoff race, the major impact was this last trip that Trump made to Georgia in one of the counties that was considered to be a Republican stronghold and one that he thought he could win again. He had won it before in 2016. And if you happen to watch the video of this, he got up and he spoke, for quite a while. And he spent maybe 2 minutes talking about these two Republican Senate candidates. And the rest of the time, what a surprise, he spent it all talking about himself and his grievances about losing or having an election stolen from him. Stop the theft, stop the steal, If you were those two people who were running for re-election, and Purdue and Loeffler, and you looked at this and you thought, why did I even come? You know, and they should have known better, of course, because Trump only talks about himself. He only thinks about himself. But still, you know, if Trump was popular, it would be good for them, at least as a photo opportunity, to be seen on the stage with him. Well, he made it all about himself. And so, and worse than that, to answer your question specifically, Ryan, he repeated what he had said for days, weeks, that the election is rigged. And he was telling voters, including Republican voters in Georgia, that the election is rigged. Well, if it's rigged and you're a Republican voter, then why bother voting? Right? And so I think his impact was in some ways catastrophic on the Republican Party, which I think in some ways they got what they deserved with this because they backed him. And now they're reaping what they sow, as they say. And the impact of that is, of course, to give control of the Senate back to the Democrats at this point, who now have run the table remarkably and control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And Mitch McConnell is no longer going to be the leader of the United States Senate. Even Lindsey Graham, if you watched him a couple nights ago, when they were going through the process of counting the ballots and, you know, people were going to get up and object, even Lindsey Graham got up and finally did his, after he tried to save face for Donald Trump, he finally said, that's it, I washed my hands, you know, I'm done with them too. And that's the price they're paying at this point. And it all goes back to one person. It was Trump. Trump is the reason the party got big and powerful. And then Trump is the reason the party imploded, as it is doing right now.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking once again with one of our favorite people to have on the Public Morality, political commentator Joe Tooman. And Joe, before we go any further, because we have much more to talk about, you have to give us an update on your grandson, August, because as I recall, he got his first national publicity on the Public Morality. So how's he doing?
He's turning 3 in about 2 months. He's extremely talkative. I don't know where he gets that from. and he's doing just fine. Thank you for asking. He's the love of my life. Absolutely. There's a reason I want to get up in the morning.
Now Joe, I hate to tell you this, but you do realize he was a month old the first time you were on the Public Morality. It goes fast.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. But thank you for asking. That's very kind.
You know, now you've touched on this. Now I want to come back to it. You know, now that President-elect Biden has what every president has had the first time they were elected in the last 32 years. I don't know if you realize this, but his party has majorities of both chambers, albeit slim. Yeah. Explain to our listeners how that impacts his presidency, especially in the first 18 months. I'm allowing for 6 months before the midterms for everyone to scatter. But
well, sure, it's a great question, and so the quick answer on this is that being in control of both chambers, both houses of Congress means that, for example, this desire in the House of Representatives to increase the dollar amount given to people who've lost their jobs in the middle of the pandemic. $600 is not going to get you through to the end of the month, even, you know, for most people. And there was this drive to make it $1,200 instead. And that was blocked by Mitch McConnell. Well, that means now that's going to be a possibility. And I don't think that Chuck Schumer is going to be the new leader of the Senate is just going to railroad things through. He's, you know, it is, as you said, it's a modest majority with Vice President Harris, you know, casting the deciding vote to break ties. But that means that they're still going to have to be some negotiation. And thankfully, one of the good things about the United States Senate is that there are people there who are willing to work with people on the other side. And part of the advantage of having longer terms of office in the United States Senate is that people working next to each other eventually develop friendships and relationships, and that's the stuff that makes people able to work with one another. They get past their animus and their hostility that, you know, a Republican will never talk to a Democrat and vice versa. they're just people, and they have to work with each other, and they will, I think, going forward. It'll, you know, but as I said, the Democratic majority, if you want to call it that, in the Senate won't be able to mandate. They're still going to have to negotiate, but they're in the dominant position without question. Absolutely.
Staying on that thread, it has become the norm in recent decades that nothing gets done in Congress unless the president, his party has control of both chambers of Congress. And given the fact that political parties were not even part of what the founders were thinking when the Constitution was ratified, can anything be done, in your view, to minimize the obstruction that, in my view, has been normalized in our 21st century context?
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's all the rule changes and always justifying the rule changes to benefit yourself by claiming that the other side did it too. It has been very damaging. But, you know, it's also worth remembering, though, since we're considering the relevance of the parties also in the context of the role of Congress, you know, the founders were still looking, as you know, for a balance of powers so that the legislative branch, which was on a more regular basis sort of subject to the vote of the people, is balanced against the executive branch, the presidency, and of course you have the judicial branch as well, which is supposed to be apolitical and doesn't stand for office, and they get life tenure when they're on there in their positions. In that context, if we think beyond the parties but actually think about the structure of government, the whole point of this was to encourage working together, that no one entity would dominate and dictate to others. Now, that hasn't always been that way for the last couple of years with this president. And I think his behavior, going back to your question about political parties, has certainly emboldened the Republican Party to the point where, you know, people like Senator Cruz or Senator Hawley, who should know better, sort of got greedy and kind of looked at the opportunities for them of a presidential base of 75 or whatever million voters, thinking that they could get those the next time around. And their behavior recently in terms of enabling Trump by perpetuating his lies about the November election is evidence of this. And that's something we're going to have to deal with. And people like that, frankly, I know we haven't talked yet about the insurrection, what happened on Wednesday, but frankly, their behavior in all of this, particularly on behalf of the Republican Party, contributed to what happened. And it was not the sole responsibility of these people, but they certainly, by enabling Trump's lies, encouraged the terrible thing that's happened to this country. And frankly, I think those guys should resign. There's not a chance that they're going to win anything in 2024. The negative advertising on them will write itself for what they did.
I'm not quite sure the actual numbers, and you sort of alluded to it earlier, but at least in my lifetime, this is the first election that I felt like as many people voted against President Trump as voted for Joe Biden, and maybe higher.
Yeah.
Given that, and I don't know if that's true or not, but that's just sort of my hypothesis, but given that, if you were giving counsel to the Democratic Party, what do they need to do? Because we know traditionally midterm elections decrease, especially by the party in power. So what do they need to do if they want to expand those numbers in the Senate?
Well, you have to look at and see which seats, of course, are open and in what states we're talking about. But I think generally from the Democratic side, the voting issue for voters in any state is still the pandemic. It's about the federal response to this. You know, Trump will get some credit, I guess, for shutting China off from being able to take airplane rides over from China to the United States. You know, he was a little late to the party on that, but he did do that. And he'll get some credit for speeding up the time to make vaccines available. That's all nice. But the distribution of vaccines, the carrying out of this to vaccinate a sizable population, they've left that to the states, which were completely underprepared for this and require federal guidance, particularly on the distribution level. And so my answer to your question is, to be more brief, I'm sorry. I think that's job one for Biden and for the administration, is to be dealing with that immediately and showing the public that they can have some calm restored. Mr. Trump has barely talked about the COVID virus in that little nonsensical tape he made yesterday under threat of whatever, when he finally had to comment on the insurrection. He briefly mentioned, that people had died because of the COVID virus, and that was sad. And how often have we heard him say that? He rarely, if ever, talks about it. But Joe Biden talks about it all the time, and that's part of the reason he got elected. People weren't just making choices when they voted for Biden over Trump from places like Georgia because they liked Biden more. They're voting that way because Biden was talking about the thing they were most afraid of, and they were hoping somebody would deal with. And Trump has shown little to zero interest in this topic for quite some time. It's part of the reason that people voted against him. So that's my answer. I think that one of the ways that you can enlarge the Senate, the share of senators in the United States Senate who are Democrat, is to make not just the president, but the president as part of the Democratic brand, a focus on dealing with this pandemic and getting it out of the way, because there are plenty of conservatives, including some of those people who were demonstrating earlier this week, who would love to be told they don't have to wear masks anymore, they don't have to wash their hands anymore, they can eat inside a restaurant if they want to. That's the sort of stuff they're waiting to hear. And if it's a Democratic Party that delivers that, they'll go for it. Likewise, if it's a Democratic Party that gets people out of work, checks for $1,200 or $1,600, and now they're talking about $2,000. I'm not sure if that'll happen or not, but that's going to give a lot of those people hope. And at come election time, they're going to remember which party was encouraging doing that and which party was sitting on their hands saying, no, that's too much money. And that speaks for itself. So it's the pandemic. It's dealing with the COVID virus in all of its different machinations.
Explain, if you would, to our listeners why many feel that the actions of those 12 Republican senators you mentioned, Senator Cruz and Senator Hawley by name, but because they were prepared to challenge the re-election, the certification, I should say, President-elect Biden, why did many view those actions as seditious? Explain that, please.
As seditious?
Yes.
Well, I think this begins first by identifying the insurrection itself. The sole reason that groups like the group that calls itself the Proud Boys or any of a number of American neo-Nazi groups or white supremacist groups got involved with this was they were already living and communicating within an ecosystem where they repeated their own lies to one another. And in Donald Trump, they got somebody who was way better at lying than they were. This effort at an insurrection, which is, and it turns out to be a violent challenge to the lawful authority of a central government, which is what happened Wednesday, began with this perpetuation of lies by these different groups. And Trump, I'm not sure if he was smart enough to know that he could manipulate these people to do what he wanted, or it was just a bad confluence of him wishing for that result and them taking him up on the offer. But the end result of this was something terrible. An assault to our, it wasn't just a building that was assaulted. It was the image of the United States, the strongest democracy, the best example of a democracy. That's how we label ourselves on the planet. And what are other countries that we've been lecturing for a long time to think of this? think of us after what happened. It's unimaginable, the damage that's been done. And it's going to take more than Joe Biden to fix that, frankly. It's going to be years before the mess of this, the detritus of this left behind of all the problems goes away. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No.
I may have drifted.
Joe, you always answer my questions. That's why we keep that's why we keep having you back. You and the adorable photos you post of August. That's why we keep having you back. But given your last answer, can the Republican Party in its present state, because of January 6th, can it continue in its present state, or do you see it sort of fracturing?
I see it fracturing, definitely. But you know, I have to tell you, I grew up in San Joaquin Valley, which is a very conservative. It's an agricultural belt, if you like, in California, Central California. Very conservative. My parents were, you know, two of 11 whole Democrats in our town of about 10,000 people. And so I grew up knowing more children of more Republicans than I did, you know, finding anybody who's had the same political tendencies as my parents. And these all grew up to be fine people. Some of them I knew ran for office, and they're all good people. And I don't automatically, and I don't think anyone else should either, automatically assume that because someone is a member of a political party that they buy into all the beliefs of that and the rest of it. And so I'd like to think that the Republican Party can rebuild. It was originally, as you know, the party of Lincoln. The point, it was an abolitionist party designed originally to eliminate slavery. Over the course of more than a century, it went where the voters were, just like the Democratic Party did. The Democrats settled and concentrate in cities, and Republicans typically have sheltered or migrated to rural areas. And so that geography in some ways and those populations dictate what the parties become. So this party right now, which for a long time, the Republicans, has been a party about law and order, about balanced budgets and not being wasteful with money and lowering taxes, all those sorts of things, and building a strong economy. Those were, and the religious aspect of this as well, you know, very pro-Christian and the like, is now associated with a president who will replace Richard Nixon historically as you know, someone suffering this label of being a terrible president and producing on this past week a day of infamy, a shame. They're tagged with that. And, you know, they could have avoided this, frankly, if they had the courage to do what Mitt Romney chastised them about earlier this week, if they just told Trump's base the truth about the fact that Biden had won the election fair and square in November. They could have saved themselves a world of trouble. But now, just as President Trump is labeled a liar, Republicans will be associated with that big lie as well. You tell a lie often enough, it eventually becomes the truth. That was what Joseph Goebbels taught Adolf Hitler. And I don't mean to go too far in criticizing Senator Cruz, but he was somebody who was being willing to stand up and challenge these election results, was perpetuating a lie. And he knew it was a lie. They all knew it was a lie. And it became the truth for Trump's base, for those people who voted for him, and also for those same people who assaulted the federal capital, the Capitol building. And they have to answer for that, and they will the next time they run for election, because anybody running against Cruz or Hawley or any of the others that you mentioned, we haven't named, it's not going to be that hard to come up with the arguments or the negative advertising against those guys. You just show what their votes were going to be, and or what they were saying about the president's lies, and you show the video of the assault on the Capitol. And Cruz was asked today in an interview, do you feel responsible for what happened? And he takes about 5 seconds to answer this, and he's really nervous. And then finally he says, no, I'm not responsible. Well, that sounds like Donald Trump talking again. And voters aren't going to forget that. And so in that sense, I do think this is a party, a political party, in crisis. It doesn't, I don't think it deserves to, or I won't say it doesn't deserve to, I'll just say I don't think it wants to be associated with Mr. Trump anymore. I think they want to get as far away from him as possible. And if they want to have any hope of some midterm surprises, and you know what, the House of Representatives might be in play in 2 years. It happens. We make these corrections, and voters typically do that because they want there to be a balance of powers. Given the fact that the Dems right now control all three, the executive and both houses in the Congress, I can perfectly see Republican voters looking for an opportunity to vote for a Republican in the House instead of a Democrat. But you have to, in order to get them to do that, you have to turn them out. There are a lot of people who probably are turned off by elections after this. And you also have to assure them that the lies that were perpetuated before won't be repeated. They have some cleaning up to do where that's concerned.
Staying on this, and we'll switch, but staying on this for just a moment. You know, one of the hallmarks of a republic is that there comes a point within our civic virtue that I support Joe Tumen. I actually did support Joe Tumen a long time ago, but that's another story. But I support Joe Tumen. But there comes a point, if Joe Tumen says something, you know, as a citizen, or as a fellow legislator, we're in the same party, there has to be a point that I'm unwilling to go. You know, just because Joe Tumen said it can't be enough. And isn't that a danger on how Republican small r forms of government implode by the unwillingness to do that?
Yeah. But, you know, I think in the case of, if we just stay on the two we've named, Holling and Cruz, you know, I'm not defending them, believe me, at all in this. I think they got big eyes when they saw, reminded how much Trump won, even though he lost that race. And they said to themselves, oh, we're a minority party, but if we start grabbing that kind of vote total, we can be the majority party. And, of course, both of these guys, along with some others, were naive enough to think they could inherit that base from Trump. And, of course, that's based on the assumption that Trump is gone, and I don't think that Trump thinks that way. So a lot of this was, my mother used to say, I would get in trouble sometimes when I was a kid and went to restaurants, and I'd order something that's way too much food. And my mother would say, order with your stomach, not with your eyes. Right? In other words, don't order food you can't eat. And this is what happened with Cruz and Holly. They looked at this and they said, we can inherit that. Let's back the Trump up on this and perpetuate the lie, and then we'll grab those 75 million. Well, good luck. Not going to happen now. You're part of the big lie. And they should have ordered with their eyes. Pardon me, their stomach. Not with their eyes. My mom's going to be mad at me now.
We've talked a lot about Republicans, and we haven't gotten to the insurrection yet, but we've talked a lot about Republicans, but what are the dangers lurking for the Democratic Party on the horizon?
Well, as I said, I think it is natural in our history politically for there to be midterm corrections where people will say, let's not give one party all of it. So I would not be surprised to see more seats in the House taken by Republicans. Best way for the Democrats to avoid that, on top of insulating themselves by vigorously pursuing a COVID strategy and backing the president when he wants to move on this stuff. The other thing they can do, I think, is continue for the Democrats to support financial help for people who've lost jobs, and try and put people back on their feet where this is concerned. I expect on the Democratic, or I'm sorry, we're talking about Republicans, right?
No, Democrats.
Well, I think just to finish out the point on this, it's still quite possible that there will be gains made on the other side. It's not unusual. And remember, there were 75 million people who voted for Donald Trump. I don't know how many of them are still going to want to support him after what happened this week. because some, you know, the people who are really Trump people, the ones who are marching and damaging the building, those people are sort of in their own universe. But I'm talking about moderate Republicans who just kind of like Trump because during his era, the stock market might have gone up, or they may have appreciated some of the tax changes that he made. But other than that, they're not hugely invested in this. And your question is, are they going to want to go for Republicans, or would they sit out the next election if they're not happy with either party?
You sort of touched on this already, but we're going to talk specifically about it. Is there any way to describe the melee that occurred on Capitol Hill this week other than a failed insurrection to disrupt American democracy?
Yeah, I think that's it's accurate. I'm not sure if it failed in the sense that they didn't succeed in toppling the government. It succeeded in the sense that it for the moment disrupted the counting of the Electoral College votes, which I think was Mr. Trump's initial ambition in this. And boy, he sure didn't think that through, obviously. And I think the other and longer term damage is how this new debacle, I mean, there's no other way to describe it, is firmly to be laid at Trump's feet on this. I mean, he was the one that set this up. He was the one who told the Proud Boys before, you know, back off and or stand down, but be ready, right? Meaning I'm going to use you eventually. Trump was the one who made in the state of Michigan that tweet to undercut the governor's authority there, Gretchen's authority, that masks should be worn. When he tweeted out, liberate Michigan, what the hell does that mean? Let's remember it was those same Proud Boys that hatched this numbskull scheme to kidnap the governor, to try her, in like a kangaroo court, and then execute her. And thankfully, the FBI intervened and arrested a bunch of them and protected her. But, you know, it's amazing that if that happened, the president said very little about it. And senators like the ones we've been talking about, or members of the House and the Republican Party, knew that those things had happened before. And they didn't imagine that it could happen here in Washington, D.C. as well with this group. But, you know, it's a huge screw-up. Not just in the Congress, also in our law enforcement community as well. We should have expected this, frankly. It was staring at us all the time. And it could happen again, frankly.
Well, Joe, you sort of touched on this as well, but you talked about how Senator Hawley, and I'm assuming given their educational background, and Senator Cruz, you know, knew better. We had elections verified at the state level. We had decisions rendered by more than 100 state and federal judges appointed by Democrats and Republicans, including the Supreme, including the Supreme Court, that said there was no election malfeasance. But yet, we've never had a conspiracy theory, not even the Kennedy assassination conspiracy theory, that had a shelf life that so threatened our democracy.
I agree. I think that's true. Maybe the difference, Myron, is we've also never had a president like Trump. It's interesting that he self-identifies as this stable genius or something like that. I don't know that I would call him either stable or a genius, but he is clever for what that's worth. And he has been a master of the ability to self-promote, no question. And we know he is, I don't mean to psychoanalyze him, but I will. He's a sociopath. He's pathological. He is a perpetual liar. In fact, when you want to figure out what he actually means as the truth, you just assume it's the opposite of what he's saying because he lies all the time. And so for somebody like Mr. Trump, I mean, think, have we ever had a president who does this? Right? I mean, maybe Richard Nixon would be the closest, but even Nixon told the truth about some things as well. And was a bad president and a bad man. But, you know, Trump is in a category by himself. And so to your question, I don't think we've ever had anybody like Trump before. And I don't think that these conspiracy theories or fake stories would ever have happened with other presidents. Trump used every opportunity, whenever a microphone was put in front of him, or he was taping something, or he was tweeting, every opportunity to demean and besmirch and denigrate the election in November, even before it happened, by saying, if I lose, it'll be because they cheated. And then after he lost, well, they didn't win, I won. They cheated. And he must have had a daily dose of that, you know, three or four times a day since November. He understood the point I was making about with Goebbels and Hitler and the Nazis' rhetoric to try and justify the mass murder of millions of innocent Jews in the Second World War. If you tell a lie often enough, eventually it becomes the truth, and that's what happened here. We've never had a president with those skills, which I don't admire, by the way, and a ruthless willingness to use them the way he did.
You mentioned
that's unique.
You mentioned Richard Nixon. One could make the argument in 1960, Richard Nixon had a better case to suggest that the election was stolen from him than this president, but yet he chose not to go down this road.
Yeah, there were certainly allegations in 1960 about some malfeasance on the part of Democrats. That's something that Kennedy lived with, and Kennedy was also a unique kind of candidate, the good-looking guy, great public speaker, probably a skirt chaser as well, if you believe the rumors about Marilyn Monroe and the rest of it, and probably somebody like Trump who got away with a lot. But I think I don't want to make the comparison to Trump too much because, you know, Kennedy was also an intellectual. He was well-read. He wrote books as well as read them and was a very smart person and actively involved in the country. Mr. Trump has been mostly about himself, and that's where I think the difference is.
On that note, Joe, did his two-minute speech where he's I'm assuming he acknowledged that Joe Biden won the election. Does that make a difference at all in your mind?
For Trump, no. In fact, I think that he may have made it worse for himself when he did that. The speech was taped. You and I have both been in watching politics long enough to know the difference between when someone's reading the speech and someone's actually speaking from the heart. His tone was flat. He clearly was forced into saying the things that he had to say. And it was a remarkable, it showed remarkable chutzpah, you know, gall, for him to blame initially the demonstrators, the let's call them what they were. I won't call them demonstrators. They were domestic terrorists. He blamed them for their violence and said they'd be held to account. Well, if I was one of the poor boys or I was one of those chuckleheads who thought it was a good idea to do to the state capitol, the federal capitol, what they did, I'd be pretty mad at Trump because Trump is making it sound like they did this. And it was breathtaking in that little 2-minute segment to see that he took no responsibility for it himself when clearly his words incited their behavior, just like his son's words did right after he was done speaking and Rudy Giuliani as well when he said, let's do trial by combat. And, you know, everybody knew this was coming. And Trump yesterday said nothing about this. To me, now I'm just speaking as a private citizen, that was the moment where I felt for myself he needed to be out of the office at this point. It doesn't matter if it's going to happen in 14 days. He's already shown how much reckless damage he can do in a couple of hours. I wouldn't leave him the keys to anything at this point. And you know what? Nancy Pelosi feels that way too, which is why, as you and I are speaking now, I just turned off the tube before you called. They've drafted at least one article of impeachment, and they've got seven more. And Pelosi is looking to have a conversation with the vice president today, saying, if you don't invoke the 25th, we will take this to the floor and start counting votes, because we're going to force the president to resign. And this is becoming, I think, very quickly, similar to the end of Watergate, where Nixon was eventually forced to resign when it was obvious that nobody was going to support him anymore. And rather than be impeached and removed and then charged, he resigned. I suspect Mr. Trump will be forced into this as well.
Well, this is the first week of 2021, and I have a sneaking suspicion at some point during the year of 2021, we're going to have Joe Tooman back. I want you to, in the meantime, though, I want you to practice and get. I want you to practice with August and get him ready, because we're going to start. We're going to put you to the side and just start having him on and get his analysis. So,
okay. So,
but my friend Joe Tooman, thank you so much for joining
thank
us
you.
Today on the Public Morality.
Yeah, always good to talk to you.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at Byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you receive your podcasts. Once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WJAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast The Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. In the words of Martin Luther King, we may have come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. For all of us at The Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.